audio for personal listening of Book of, that is, most of, Lowell Thomas, Jr.'s, Out of This World, Across the Himalayas to Forbidden Tibet, from nearly 80 years ago, 1950. New York, The Greystone Press, 1950. About this book, Out of This World is the story of the trek my father and I made to the Dalai Lama's throne at Lhasa. This journey came as a climax to my father's lifetime of adventure. For me, it was probably the greatest travel adventure I will ever have, unless, someday, it will be possible to journey by spaceship to another planet. Words cannot express my everlasting gratitude to Dad, without whom I never would have seen the Forbidden Land. He had the dream and, in his incredible way, was able to make it come true. There have been few books by Westerners about Tibet, fewer still with illustrations, and none, so far as I know, with pictures in color. I am particularly proud that so many of my photographs could be included in this volume. They make a major contribution to our story. Indeed, many of them speak chapters by themselves. For both of us, I wish to express our deep gratitude to all who helped our Tibetan caravan onto the Himalayan high road to Lhasa. Ambassador Loy Henderson, Consul General Charles H. Derry, J. Jefferson Jones, then First Secretary at the United States Embassy, and Bob Burnett of Pan American Airways. We also wish to express our gratitude to Sir Gershwin Kabajpai and all of his associates in the Indian Ministry of External Affairs, who cooperated with Ambassador Henderson. Without the help of these splendid people, getting to Lhasa would still be only a dream. Very much in order is a special salute to publisher Ed Anthony of Collier's Magazine and his editorial associates, whose enthusiasm and cooperation were an important factor in bringing this story to light. I would like, also, to extend a low bow to Miss Elsie Weil, one of America's leading authorities on Asia, whose contribution by way of research, organization and editing has been invaluable in the setting down of this account of our crossing of the Himalayas to the land of the Lamas. Pauling, N. Y. Incoherent texts that appear here, may be captions that have not been removed, or just picture texts. 1. Invitation to Lhasa. The miracle has happened. Meet me in Calcutta. We are on our way to Lhasa. With this breathtaking wireless, my father greeted me in Tehran on July 14, 1949, upon my return from a week's expedition among the Bakshari tribesmen of eastern Iran with United States Supreme Court Justice William O. Douglas. No one with a taste for adventure could fail to be pleased at receiving such news. As for me, I was so cheered with the prospect of leaving the hot barren plains of Iran that I literally turned cartwheels for joy. The film and study of Iran that I was in the process of completing could wait forever, for all I cared. Here was an opportunity that in all time has come to only a handful of Westerners, an invitation to enter the most remote and secluded of countries and to visit its capital, Lhasa. Forbidden Tibet. Westerners have called it that for centuries. The mysterious mountain kingdom beyond the towering Himalayas on the very roof of the world has long been the number one Eldorado for explorers and travelers with a keen appetite for the unknown. But since visitors from the West first found their way to Central Asia, only a few have been able to penetrate that sealed and silent land. Even fewer have been permitted to visit its fabulous capital, the sacred city of Lhasa, home of the Dalai Lama, religious and temporal ruler of Tibet, and spiritual head of millions of Buddhists in northern Asia. You can well imagine my surprise on receiving that amazing telegram from my father. Before I shoved off for Persia, we had talked briefly about the prospect of visiting Tibet. My father said that he intended to write to some friends in India about it. But the idea had struck me as so fantastic that I completely dismissed it from my mind. What was the background of our incredible adventure? I must confess that I played no part in obtaining entrance permission from the Dalai Lama's government. That was entirely my father's doing. It may be hackneyed to say so, but this trip seemed to be one of those dreams that come true. Perhaps Dad even had visions of Tibet when he was a boy in the old Colorado gold camp of Cripple Creek. At any rate, from the gold seekers he early acquired a determination to visit far-off places. and the desire to travel eventually nourished a craving to reach Tibet and make that almost impossible journey to Lhasa, because for centuries it has been the classic of the difficult. As a young adventurer during and after World War I, my father was intrigued by three so-called forbidden spots on the globe: Arabia, Afghanistan and Tibet. Reaching Arabia first, Dad discovered a bonanza of romance in the person of Lawrence of Arabia, the fabulous young Englishman who led the Arab revolt in the War of the Desert. That gave him a story to tell both in a book and on the lecture platform. Next, he succeeded in getting into Afghanistan, realizing a second ambition. To the east of Afghanistan, beyond the lofty ranges of the Karakorams and Himalayas, lies Tibet, the goal of goals. 30 years ago, Dad arrived in India for 2 years of travel in southern and central Asia. At that time he had hopes of getting to Lhasa. But not a chance. Other travels followed: a 28,000-mile flight to Europe, Asia and Africa in the primitive plains of 1926. On that trip he became acquainted with the jovial sailor Count Felix von Luckner, who during World War I commanded the Windjammer, sailing the Atlantic and Pacific as a daring sea raider. Luckner came to America with my father, who recorded his story in two books about the sea devil. But again he was recounting another's travels and adventures instead of his own. Then came radio and long years of broadcasting the world's news, also days and nights of newsreel deadlines. During World War II there were hurried broadcasting journeys to other lands, including one around the world. On the latter, Dad once more found himself deep in China along the Tibetan frontier. Fortunately, I share my father's desire for travel and adventure. As a youngster, I made a voyage around Cape Horn with a United States Navy squadron. Later I joined a mountain climbing expedition in Alaska. And after serving as an Air Force pilot during the last war, I flew to Bikini and on round the globe with Air Secretary W. Stuart Symington, now chairman of the National Security Resources Board. Then followed an expedition to Turkey, and another to Iran. Although Dad had about given up hope of ever seeing Lhasa, he had not forgotten his old dream. So when, out of the blue, word came late in May, 1949, that he could get away for 8 or 10 weeks, his first real vacation in 19 years on the air, it took him all of a minute to decide where he would like to go. Lhasa. He confided to Mother. Maybe it is impossible, especially on such short notice. Yet this is likely to be my one and only chance. A million toon shot, but I'll try. Off went an airmail letter to Loy W. Henderson, Washington's new ambassador to India. Congratulating him on his appointment, Dad added this postscript: "Now that you are in Hindustan, a land of miracles, how about performing a miracle? How about arranging for me, my son and three other Americans to visit Tibet? Is there any hope?" The ambassador promptly replied, explaining that the doors to Tibet seemed more tightly closed than ever. He also reminded my father that we have no official diplomatic contact with the Dalai Lama. Another friend in India, Sir Gershankar Bajpai, top official in Prime Minister Nehru's Ministry of External Affairs, confirmed what Loy Henderson had said. But apparently both Sergei and the ambassador liked the idea, hopeless though it seemed, and sent my father's request across the Himalayas to Lhasa. Miracles still happen. A midnight call came from our State Department, relaying a radio message from Tibet, via India, saying, "You are invited to Lhasa. Come at once." But permission was not granted for a party of five, only for Dad and me. We were to enter by way of Gangtok, capital of the Himalayan state of Sikkim, via the caravan route over Nathula, a 14,800-foot pass. By this time, two precious weeks of vacation had already gone by, and Dad knew he could not possibly make the trip, with all the caravan travel from India to Lhasa and back, in the time that remained. Part of the journey would have to be on his sponsor's time. That difficulty suggested another idea to complete the project. Why couldn't Dad resume his program from Tibet, culminating with broadcasts from Lhasa? This certainly was piling fantasy on fantasy, since Tibet has no radio facilities and very little electricity. However, there was a way out. New recording devices were available, portable recorders which could be used for long-distance broadcasts, even from the heart of Asia. Why not take those battery-driven outfits to Tibet? There were many fascinating sights to be seen on the rocky road to Lhasa. So many, in fact, that the travelers don't seem to have shaved every morning. Enthusiastic gave my father a leave of absence to undertake a sort of broadcast travel diary from the roof of the world. While a number of big-name guest speakers would take his place on the show, Dad and I would come in from along the route, wherever possible, with our tape recorders. As I set down our experiences here at home, I find it hard to believe that we ever were in Tibet. But a pair of crutches in the attic serves as a reminder of Dad's serious accident on the return trip from Lhasa to India and of those weeks the Tibetan villagers lifted and bounced and hoisted his litter over their mountain passes. Even so, it already seems that it must have happened to two other people. When we returned from this highest and most inaccessible of countries, we felt that we were coming out of the 7th century into the 20th. We were emerging from a land where there was little to remind us of the outside world. Once we crossed the Himalayas into Tibet, we were indeed travelers in the land of the lost horizon. And it often seemed as though we were dreaming, acting the parts of characters in James Hilton's novel, On Our Way to Shangri-La. Practically all grade school pupils are familiar with the large area on the map of Central Asia marked with the word Tibet. But until we went there, we had no conception of how remote it really is. The Antarctic region is usually considered the most distant spot on our planet. Still, it takes longer to get from any one of Tibet's neighbors to the capital city of Lhasa than to journey by sea from South America to the Antarctic by air. That's impossible, since the Tibetans absolutely forbid travel by air, by car, or even by carriage or cart. As far as transportation is concerned, Tibet is a country without a wheel. This seems incredible, considering that theirs is a civilization much older than our own. You can reach Lhasa only by making a long overland journey, a trip by caravan that takes from 3 to 4 months by many of their routes. And by the shortest route, with horses, yaks, mules and donkeys, a caravan will take from 3 to 4 weeks, assuming it carries the Dalai Lama's passport, guaranteeing assistance and safer passage. Tibet's close neighbors are also difficult to reach. To the west is Ladakh, an outer province of Kashmir, sometimes called Little Tibet. To the south are a group of partially explored semi-independent states, Nepal, which few Westerners have been allowed to enter, a wild, mountainous bit of Bengal, the picturesque mountain state of Sikkim, which is the main gateway to Tibet, the hermit country of Bhutan, and half-explored Himalayan sections of Assam and Burma. To the east of Tibet lies a part of China's far west with which few Chinese are well acquainted, mountains inhabited by aboriginal tribes. Only a few Western missionaries, explorers and airmen have ever been there. To the north are those two vast, sparsely populated regions of lofty mountains and forbidding deserts, Russian and Chinese Turkestan, the latter now known as Xinjiang. As for Tibet itself, nature has, for the most part, lavishly cooperated to isolate the people from undesired visitors, at least up to the present time. Far above the timberline, at altitudes averaging from 14,000 to 18,000 feet above sea level, this vast, windswept tableland is guarded by bleak deserts and a great girdle of glacier-crowned mountains, some 5 miles high. Two world wars have brought startling changes to most of the globe, but so far not to Tibet. It remains a feudal theocracy, ruled with an iron hand by 200,000 all-powerful Buddhist monks who have fiercely resisted nearly every attempt by unwelcome intruders to invade their solitude. It is not surprising, therefore, that except for a few explorers, travelers and specialists, most Westerners are vaguely and often incorrectly informed about this mountain country in the heart of Central Asia, isolated both by geography and the will of its people. For example, a popular and up-to-date American atlas offers the following data on Tibet, nominally Chinese. That's wrong. Area approximately 470,000 square miles. Wrong. Population 1 million. That, too, is wrong. What's the population of that little country? A former American editor and publisher asked us on our return home. No census has ever been taken, we replied, but most estimates are between 3 and 5 million. And it isn't such a little country, it's about a third as large as the United States, although the frontiers have been defined only roughly. Another query has frequently cropped up since our return. Many persons have come to me after my illustrated talk on Tibet with the comment, a newsreel not long ago showed India's Prime Minister Nehru landing at an airfield in Tibet, and being greeted by the Dalai Lama. So, when that accident happened to your father, why didn't a rescue plane fly in and pick you both up? Why did he have to be carried for 16 days on the shoulders of Tibetans? Well, the newsreel must have photographed two other persons in a different country. First of all, Prime Minister Nehru has never been in Tibet. Second, no airplane is allowed to land there. Of course, a plane might accidentally crash in Tibet. This actually happened to 5 American Air Force men during World War II. We had a long discussion with a Tibetan official in Giants, trying to determine why these people are so insistent on shutting out the rest of the world. Don't you want any of the conveniences of the modern age? We asked. Well, perhaps. He hesitated. We are willing to accept them as we accept arms. The lamas invariably give the same answer. They are convinced that they alone of all peoples are not slaves to the gadgets and whirring wheels of the industrial age. They want no part of it. To them the devices, doodads and superioyos, the symbols of our Western civilization, are toys, of no real value. To the more so they want you to believe only the things of the mind are of lasting importance. So that's why, in a land about an ethherd the size of the United States, with a population of about 4 million, you find no airplanes, automobiles, railroads, wagons, bicycles, factories, hospitals, newspapers, magazines, plumbing, running water, heating and sewerage systems, in fact almost none of the mechanical devices and services that we regard as necessities of life. It should be mentioned that a few of the lay nobles and traders who send caravans to India and China have battery-operated radios. Also, one generator in Lhasa supplies electricity to the dim bulbs in a few buildings. Although Tibet turns a cold shoulder on modern conveniences, it must not be inferred that it is a primitive, uncultured nation. On the contrary, without benefit of science, the land of the Dalai Lama has maintained a unique and individual civilization of high order for many centuries, especially in art, architecture, religious philosophy, literature and folklore. A British authority on Tibet, Graham Sandburg, in The Exploration of Tibet, wrote in 1904, views who from the outer world have gained entrance to Tibet and made real journeys in the country, still form a select and notable body of men. And that statement still stands. The Tibetans, inherently suspicious of all foreigners, want it that way. Is it any wonder then that so few Westerners have gazed upon the radiance and splendor of the cluster of golden roofs which is the traveler's first view of Lhasa as he rounds the last mountain? In the 17th and 18th centuries a few European missionaries trickled into Tibet, but they did not succeed in establishing a permanent foothold. A handful of other Europeans followed later, many of them distinguished explorers and geographers, who faced untold perils and traveled in disguise. From 1904, when Britain sent a military expedition to Tibet to gain trade concessions, until India won her independence in 1947, British trade and political agents kept in close touch with Tibet, but mostly from the Indian side of the border. As for Americans, many have tried but only a few have reached Lhasa. In fact, we were the 7th and 8th to be received officially by the Tibetan ruler, who is worshipped as a god. Swayam Cutting, naturalist and leader of museum expeditions, was the first of our countrymen to reach Lhasa. That was in 1935. 2 years later he was invited to return with his wife. The third American to see the Potala and the Dalai Lama was Theos Bernard of Arizona. In 1942, two United States Army officers, Lieutenant Colonel Ilya Tolstoy and Captain Brooke Dolan, became the fourth and fifth Americans to have an audience with the Dalai Lama. They were sent by the Office of Strategic Services to find, if they could, some new Central Asian route to ship supplies to besiege China. The sixth on the Lhasa scene, also during World War II, was Arch Steele, then a Chicago Daily News foreign correspondent, who wrote an informative series on Lamaland. We were to be next. 2. Preparations for the journey. After Dad's message about Tibet, I left Tehran in double quick time for Basra, at the head of the Persian Gulf. From that busy Iraqi seaport, celebrated as the home of Sinbad the Sailor and today the principal shipping center for the world's dates, I took off comfortably for India on one of Pan American's flying carpets. My clipper set me down in Calcutta several days ahead of my father. That barely gave me time to round up the equipment and supplies needed for our expedition. I had arrived at the height of the monsoon season, when the skies open up at any inconvenient hour of day or night. The streets were like rivers, and Calcutta's teeming millions waded through them with their shoes under their arms, while I splashed from shop to shop picking up supplies. Fortunately, most of the preliminary groundwork for the expedition had been taken care of. Our Consul General in Calcutta, Charles Derry, had considerately surveyed a number of shops to determine where I could find what would best suit our needs. Jefferson Jones, First Secretary of our embassy in Delhi, who had come down to Calcutta to give Mr. Derry a hand, had arranged about passes for the border province of Sikkim, as well as for the Lamaitk, our Tibetan visa, without which no Westerner can travel safely in Tibet. To set out on a trek like this over the highest mountain ranges and into the most remote country in the world means very careful planning. If I forgot something essential, it would be just our bad luck. No motels or lunch wagons along this trail. To mention only a few items, our equipment included saddles and bridles, army cots, and sleeping bags, mosquito netting, flashlights, a portable table, two portable chairs, a canvas bath, which we never used, and tarpaulins to keep our packs dry while moving up through the rainy forest of Sikkim to the Tibetan plateau. Our clothing on the trail would be warm ski pants, ski boots, woolen shirts, sweaters, windbreakers, ski caps, and rubberized rain suits all flown out with Dad. A first-rate medical kit is a must on an extended journey into remote country where there is no modern medicine and Tibet has next to none. But, in my frantic hurry, I failed to give this matter adequate attention. The kit I threw together was designed to take care of such problems as leech bites, minor cuts, malaria, dysentery, and headaches, and it fell far short of our needs when we ran into heavy going on the return from Lhasa, for it contains no sedatives or splints. See the appendix for an ideal list of equipment. In Calcutta I also rounded up a complete kitchen, everything from pots and pans to dish towels. The most important kitchen item, next to the cook, of course, whom we acquired later, was the portable Brimmer's cooker of American make, which I had with me in Iran. A handy gadget on any expedition, the Coleman Primus heated things quickly for us with its blowtorch flame. Without it some of our food would have been served practically raw. We used our stove even in Tibetan kitchens, whenever we could, since we did not particularly relish the peculiar and penetrating flavor of food prepared over a yak dung fire. We expected to live off the land to some extent, but to be on the safe side I bought enough food to keep us going for more than a month. At the Great Eastern Grocery I made up 8 cases of food, each case weighing 65 pounds, each containing enough food to last both of us for 6 days. Breakfast on the road to Lhasa would consist of stewed prunes or apple rings, followed by a large bowl of oatmeal or cream of wheat, canned bacon, crackers, jam and butter. As for liquids, we could have our choice of Ovaltine, coffee, tea or cocoa, topped off with powdered milk and sugar. Lunch, which we expected to eat in the saddle, would be simple but concentrated, crackers and cheese, sardines, chocolate, dried raisins, dates and figs. Our big meal was to come in the evening at the end of a long, fatiguing day of hiking and riding. after a bowl of bouillon we would have more buttered crackers and jam, then a plate of hot canned roast beef, veal or salmon, together with any fresh vegetables that we could buy along our way. Dessert would usually be dried fruit again, since Tibet is too cold to grow fruit, except for some peaches and apricots in the warmer, low-lying eastern valleys. Then more tea, cocoa or Ovaltine. What our food lacked in variety was compensated by concentrated energy, most essential in the rugged marches over high mountain trails. Before heading out across the Pacific by plane to join me in Calcutta, my father got in touch with Swayam Cutting, the naturalist and explorer, mentioned earlier as the first American to receive an official invitation to Lhasa. With not one, but three journeys into Tibet to his credit, he knew all the ropes. His suggestions were invaluable. He listed essential supplies and told Dad how shortcuts could be taken in the brief time we had to get ready. Every day on the trail we were grateful for his hint to pack our food in special cases, each one a complete unit containing everything needed from soup to salt, thus eliminating a frantic hunt through all the boxes at every stop. Swayam Cutting's instructions on what to do and what not to do saved us from making too many awkward blunders in our contact with a people who for centuries have had their own sharply defined rules of courtesy and politeness, very different from our own. For example, he warned us to carry gifts for the Dalai Lama and high dignitaries in Lhasa, as well as for other officials along the way. Not only are gifts elaborately exchanged in Tibet, we had to be provided with a bale of visiting cards. When you pay a call on a Tibetan, you present a white silk scarf, a karta. The host, in turn, presents his karta. The exchange is quite an elaborate and punctilious ceremony. Many journeys to Asia on natural history expeditions had taken Swayam Cutting to the fringes of Tibet. Naturally his appetite was whetted to cross the border and reach Lhasa, but he would not attempt the trip without official permission. On his first visit in 1930, he went as far as Giants, not too hard to negotiate, since the British were then issuing a few permits to that trading point, in accordance with a special treaty they had with Tibet. Home again, he never lost sight of his objective. To the 13th Dalai Lama, predecessor of the youth who is now temporal and religious head of Tibet, Cutting sent presents, among them such gifts as books on American architecture, a self-winding gold wrist watch, a glass cocktail shaker with a churn, which could be used to mix His Holiness's buttered tea, a pair of Dalmatian and of German hounds. His Holiness in turn sent Cutting a pair of Upsos, a special breed of Tibetan dog, with the plea to take great care of them. All this resulted in a remarkable and unparalleled correspondence between a private American citizen and the supreme ruler of Tibet, worshipped as a living god. Sometimes the 13th Dalai Lama even asked Cutting to go to Washington on missions that might lead to more direct relations between Tibet and the United States. Considering all the cordial and flourishing communications with the Dalai Lama, Cutting hoped he would soon receive an invitation to Lhasa. But none was forthcoming. Finally, on Christmas Day, 1933, he had a cable from the Kashag, the Supreme Council of Tibet, with news of the temporary passing away of His Holiness on December 17. Swayam Cutting now wondered if he ever would see Lhasa. But, persevering, he transferred his friendly attentions to the Kashag and the regent. Finally, in 1935, he received his long hapid for permission. Once in Lhasa, he made such a favorable impression on the authorities, partly because he himself thoroughly liked and admired the Tibetans, that he was invited to return in 1937 and bring his wife. He says in his book, The Fire Ox and Other Years, it was the first time an invitation had ever been extended to a white woman for an unlimited stay. The Cuttings were warmly received in Lhasa. The government placed at their disposal a charming house Zaralinga set in a private park, with willow groves and a little stream winding through the green lawns. During their occupancy, a group of young lamas from the Potala had a 10-day outing in the private park, a good opportunity to observe future Tibetan leaders enjoying their games, relaxation and outdoor feasting. In turn, the lamas, equally curious about the strangers, especially Mrs. Cutting, came in droves to the house.